the longtime critics of globalization are having another moment, claiming supply chain disruptions, high inflation, and migration are a product of an overly globalized world. But history suggests that more globalization, not less, will help counter those disruptions.
For instance, there's a substantial group of software developers all around the fringes of Europe, in Serbia, in Ukraine as well, who are working for foreign companies. And they're being paid in foreign currency. They're being paid in dollars or sometimes in euros. And that's a stunning example of a globalization of a workforce without any physical relocation. My name is Harold James. I teach history and international relations in Princeton University in the History Department in the School of Public and International Affairs. And I'm also at the moment working on the history of the International Monetary Fund.
Harold James is the author of several books, his latest being Seven Crashes, the Economic Crises That Shaped Globalization. And his latest article on the topic, In Defense of Globalization, is published in the March issue of Finance and Development magazine. So we talked before about globalization. In fact, we did a podcast 5 or 6 years ago now. And at the time, you felt it important to explain the history of globalization because it was also under fire then. And we talked a lot about the rise of populism and anti-immigration that was essentially fueling a lot of that backlash. What is different about the revolt against globalization we're seeing today, do you think?
Well, when we last spoke, the discussion, I think, was about the loss of jobs because of international trade, and people were trying to distinguish the effects of trade and technology. It wasn't an easy exercise. They were worried about migration and the effects of migration on wages and on employment. So people, particularly in the rich industrial countries, were worried about losing some jobs because of immigration in health services or hospitality or so. And the discussion after 2020 is really radically transformed because it's no longer a discussion about the way in which globalization affects living standards so much as it's a discussion about globalization producing existential threats and shortages, first of all in terms of medical equipment, but then in computer chips, and then a broader discussion of the vulnerability of supply chains. And so there's a thought after that that it's important, at least for big countries, not to be so dependent on supply chains, and that they should very, very quickly try to produce more at home. They should reshore. They should also try to trade more with friendly countries. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen talked about friendshoring. And the whole discussion, I think, has been given a new push after February the 24th last year and the Russian attack on Ukraine, in that the supply chain issues are highlighted in a new way. Russia and Ukraine are both major grain exporters. They export through the Black Sea, and the flow of food to the Middle East, above all, to the Eastern Mediterranean, but also to places as far away as Indonesia, has been interrupted by the war. Mm. And Russia had been thinking about, for a long, long time, using energy as a way of trying to get a political leverage. So the acute awareness of the geopolitics, as it were, of supply chains is, I think, the difference between the post-2020 story, and particularly the post-2022 story, and the story that we were talking about a few years ago.
So what do you see as the big risk this time in terms of the impact on the global economy? I mean, you speak of the freezing of global economic growth in your article. What do you mean by that exactly?
Well, the awareness of shortages and the focusing on supply chains means that people are much more conscious about the possible restrictions. For instance, the automobile industry was really, really badly hit by the inavailability of computer chips. And so what they want to do then is they want to stockpile things. And so instead of just-in-time delivery, you're finding people more and more concerned with stockpiling. It's certainly slowing down the global economy, but it hasn't destroyed globalization, and I think it's important to make that point as well. But it's bred a new sense of insecurity, and the problem, I think, is that it produces a kind of overreaction in that even for very large countries, it's impossible to really be completely self-sufficient. And if you think of something like the supply of the mRNA vaccines in the aftermath of the pandemic, they're produced as a result of research, but also of production activities in many, many countries. So the glass vials and the freezing equipment, and it's very, very complex. Even big countries can't really do it on their own. And certainly small countries absolutely can't do it. And so when the big countries really focus on this reshoring and on friendshoring, they're creating additional costs for themselves. Clearly, that's going to also be a drag on growth. But they're also producing a lopsidedness in the world economy because the smaller countries are really badly affected. Mm.
So you speak as well about inflation and, you know, the relationship between inflation and globalization. And a lot of people are actually out there putting the blame on globalization for the inflation, the high inflation that we're seeing these days. But your story in Finance and Development essentially flips this whole argument about globalization feeding high inflation on its head. And you say globalization is actually an antidote to inflationary pressures. What's the thinking behind that?
Absolutely. That's completely right for the Finance and Development article. And it's the result of thinking about really a long-run history of globalization since the early 19th century and the reaction that the different countries, the governments, populations had to previous episodes in which there were acute supply constraints. And I take in particular two, because I think they're really dramatic turning points in the story of globalization. The first, in the middle of the 19th century, in the 1840s, the widespread failure of harvests in Europe as a result of climate, very rainy summers, no sun, no growing season, the rain producing dampness and rot and fungal infections following from that. And most famously, of course, the Irish potato famine. But the potato was a standard crop, a staple crop, not just in Ireland, but in northwestern Europe. So massive problems there. And dealing with that, overstrained governments, many thought that they could get domestic solutions. They realized in the end that the only way of really securing an adequate and stable food supply for Europe was to globalize and to take grain from North America, from South America, increasingly also from the interior of the Russian Empire, all these areas opened up by railroads and the steamships crossing the ocean. So the big takeoff of international trade in the second half of the 19th century is really a reaction of political working out of the supply chain shocks of the 1840s. And at first, the supply chain disruptions in the 1840s produced big price increases, and the middle of the 19th century has inflation spikes. And then as you get more global trade, the wider availability of resources puts pressure downwards on prices in the same way as globalization in the early 21st century put pressure downwards on prices. So globalization, I think there was a kind of increasing acknowledgement by central banks in the early 2000s that it wasn't just good design of monetary policy. That was important, of course, but it was also the globalization environment that was putting the pressure downwards on prices and leading to what was called the Great Moderation. And the second episode that I deal with is in the 1970s, and I remember that as a student in the UK at the time when the oil price shocks hit. And again, the feeling that we're completely dependent and vulnerable. And what the 1970s produced was the second great push in globalization. And if you look at the charts of the share of trade in world output it's even much more dramatic in the 1970s and 80s as a rise than it was in the middle of the 19th century. So again, globalizing and getting more production from more distant parts of the world was a really crucial part of getting inflation down in the late 20th century.
Mm. And you mentioned steamships there at the beginning of that last answer. And technology has always played a big role in how international trade has evolved over the years. And you talk about how globalization and technology are actually tied at the hip, in a sense. How do those two things interact?
Correct. So it's exactly when you get the supply chain shocks that you suddenly realize the potential of technologies that may have been there for quite a long time. And the two examples for the historical episodes I give are the steam engine, which was around a long time from the 18th century, but the real application of the steam engine to transport and the big opening of continents through railroads and the steamships across the ocean, that's only after the middle of the 19th century, only after the supply shock. And similarly, in the 1970s, the most dramatic illustration of the process, I think, is with containerization, because there were ships that had containers, at least from the 1950s, maybe even earlier. But there aren't very many container routes. And it's suddenly in the 1970s that the real advantages of containerized shipping become apparent. If you translate that to the present, I think you can also see that what we were doing in the aftermath of the COVID shock was to use technologies that had been there for some time, but they suddenly have a new relevance and a new application. So the mRNA vaccine was developed really, the fundamental thinking behind it comes from the 1990s. And mRNA vaccines are used to treat rare tropical diseases. Suddenly you see the big application. And once that's taken place, there's an even bigger application, because it's possible, for instance, now to imagine that it's going to be used to treat many forms of cancer. So much, much more prevalent and really serious illnesses can be treated. Or, you know, another example, what we're doing at the moment, speaking remotely. Of course, you could do that before COVID, but COVID really spread that. And you can see also, I think, a dramatic spike in the use of artificial intelligence applications. So the fundamental technological transformations that our recent experience with COVID has actually not produced, but boosted or given an enormous incentive to develop further, those are even more substantial, I believe, than the innovations of the middle of the 19th century or of the 1970s.
Hmm. So what do you think will be the big, I mean, you just spoke of remote work and vaccines, but will there be a big innovation that we as a society will walk away with from these past 2 or 3 years in terms of how it might affect the ties between people and countries across the globe?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the easiest and the most obvious to think about is remote working. Mm-hmm. And so people in quite remote places away from intensely crowded big cities can work remotely. And often that's in different countries. And so, for instance, there's a substantial group of software developers all around the fringes of Europe, not so much in the European Union, but in Serbia, in North Macedonia, in Turkey, in Ukraine as well, who are working for foreign companies, and they're being paid in foreign currency. They're being paid in dollars or sometimes in euros. And they're in a way detached from their national economy. That's a stunning example of a globalization of a workforce without any physical relocation.
Right.
So, you know, that I think is a telling example that we're into already. And you can think of similar remote applications. I mean, it's standard, I think, with many, many and increasingly more prevalent types of medical practice that you can do those remotely. And again, the geography is absolutely no constraint there.
Hmm. But a lot of people actually worry about inequality, you know, increasing with all this remote work for various reasons. Is this something that you're concerned about?
Well, obviously, I mean, it produces big tensions. But I think you also have to think that you know, when you get the software developers who are working in Istanbul or Kiev, that they're producing demand, that they're consuming local products, they're contributing to the local economy. And the Kiev story is even more interesting in a way, because this big group of software developers played a very prominent role in the early phases of the invasion in terms of providing new software platforms to allow Ukrainian citizens to report the troop movements of the invading forces. So, you know, these technical nomads, as it were, they do actually contribute something to the societies that they're embedded in.
Well, Harold James, always a pleasure speaking with you. Thanks so much for taking the time.
It's great talking to you, Bruce. Thank you so much.
Harold James is a professor of history and international affairs at Princeton University and an IMF historian. Look for Harold James' latest book, Seven Crashes: The Economic Crises That Shaped Globalization, published by Yale University Press. And look for his article, In Defense of Globalization, published in the March issue of Finance and Development magazine. You can check out more IMF podcasts on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. And follow us on Twitter at IMF_podcast. I'm Bruce Edwards. Thanks for listening.